couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Lisa Frankenstein, Out of Darkness, and a look back at The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, both the 2005 version and the 1981 BBC version of it, which was actually a TV series. I'll also be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the new remastered 4K versions of Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
This is tough, because I got some very bad news this week. We lost someone in the Fat Guys family. You have probably heard me talk about Chris from Tarpon Springs. He's a devoted listener. His name was Christopher Lehman, and he'd write into the show, and every now and then I'd read an email from him or a suggestion I got through the Facebook page or something like that. I had the chance to go meet him. I was vacationing in Florida back in 2018, I believe it was. Got a chance to meet him. We hung out. We had dinner. We bought sponges because Tarpon Springs is famous for their sponges. Well, I got a call from his parents this week, and it turned out that Chris passed away unexpectedly last week. Now, Chris, he was about my age. He's a little bit younger than me, but he grew up in the 80s. So he had this great love for 80s cinema. And he had rheumatoid arthritis, which literally is a crippling disease. He had grown up with sight, but the rheumatoid arthritis, as a result, he ended up going blind. And he didn't grow effectively, so he lived in a wheelchair. And he was very, very small. But Chris was somebody I would describe as a big man with a full heart. He had a love for life. And he was dealt a bum hand, but he never felt bad about it. He struggled, and he had a lot of challenges, but he took those challenges and turned it into something positive. Like I said, Chris was wheelchair-bound. He had an electric wheelchair, and, I mean, he was faster than me on it, I'll tell you that. He had to zip around and do that, but he spent his time advocating for other people in his situation or similar situation. He worked with an organization called Wheelchairs for Kids. And that's with the number four, wheelchairsforkids.org. And what they do is they provide wheelchairs for underprivileged children. Children who, because wheelchairs are not cheap. And there's a lot of insurance that does not cover it. So he worked for this organization to help kids get wheelchairs, the ones who needed it. And he used the things life gave him, both good and bad, to make the world a better place for other people. Now, when you're in a position like me, where you're somewhat of a public figure, I don't consider myself really a public figure, but I am. I mean, my voice is out there on the radio, and people can listen to what I have to say. And there are people I've run into over the years who have been fans of the show and ask bizarre questions about movies to me. And it's a wonderful job because I don't know who's out there. I just throw this net out every week. And I don't know what misfits get caught up in this net and come after me. But I really struck up a great friendship with Chris. And he would send me messages on Facebook all the time. And sometimes it took me a while to get back to him, you know, because I would be busy. But we'd chat all the time. And he was hugely into board games, and he sent me a gift. He sent me a board game. Actually, he sent me a couple. One of them was this game called Horrified, which was about the Universal Monsters. And my family and I played it. We Skyped him in at one point or put him on Zoom or something like that. And Chris was just happy to be involved because he's just like, he loved doing board games. He knew every single board game. He was so excited about just wanting to share what he loved with other people. And when I say we lost somebody in the Fat Guys family, I'm not joking. I've always seen myself and the people that I surround myself with as the island of misfit toys. You remember Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? He goes to the island of misfit toys, and they're all toys that something's wrong with them. Like, it's not a Jack in the Box, it's a Charlie in the Box. Toys that kids didn't want. And look, the popular people always have somebody to hang out with, but the misfits don't. And I like to think of myself and the people I surround myself with are a bunch of misfits. You know, sometimes we got nowhere else to go. And we're a little weird, yeah. Maybe we like something strange. Maybe we're a little bit too much into something. Those are my people. And for as awful as the internet can be, for as caustic as social media could be, doing the show and having a presence on social media has opened me up to a whole slew of different people. And there's this small little family of people that are beyond just somebody I know who would listen to the show or somebody I know who read my reviews. And these, they're all from all over the place. You know, they're from all over the country. And there are these people over the years that I've gotten to know very well through social media and the internet and through the outreach of this show, where I think that if we all lived in the same town, we would be getting together every other weekend and watching movies and joking and goofing around. And I wish I could do that. If I lived near where Chris was, if I lived down in Tarpon Springs, I probably would have been over there all the time watching movies and joking. And the fact that he still loved movies and he couldn't see the movies. And he's one of the reasons why I've always advocated dubbing for movies, because he couldn't watch stuff with subtitles. And he was somebody who really opened my eyes, no pun intended, really opened my eyes to the voice description for people with visual impairments. This is important stuff. And yeah, fine, don't go see it in the theaters, but at least give him an option to be able to enjoy it at home, because he would still love to revisit these movies that he saw when he was younger. So Chris, my brother from the island of misfit toys, I love you, man, and I'm really gonna miss you. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. This is not a great trailer for the radio. It's actually not a bad trailer. It's A Quiet Place Day One, which is coming to theaters on June 28th. Already get a day one, because John Krasinski's character had to get him back for some reason for the second movie. But this one is when they attack. So this looks like it's going to be cool, but I'm hoping it's not going to get overly repetitive, because one of the things that really bothered me about the first sequel was at the end of that first movie, they're like, we now know what kills them. Let's go after them. And they go on the offensive, and then it's them just kind of cowering in the shadows again for the whole half of the second movie. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Despicable Me 4, which is coming to theaters on July 3rd.
Gru, I need a word with you. Your family's lives are at stake.
What?
Maxim Lamal has escaped from prison.
I'm coming for my revenge, Gru!
We have to get to the safe house.
It has a vending machine! I love this place!
The most important part of a heist is being aware of potential dangers.
I tricked myself!
The trailer's like, we're going to have this set up. You guys have to go. This villain's coming after you. And then we got nothing else. We're just going to do a bunch of gags. They literally run out of story in the trailer. So I don't know. Is this going to be any good? Who knows? Anyways, coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from the 80s to the 2000s.
Oh, despicable me.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. There's a reason I'm covering The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Labyrinth and the Dark Crystal are available on 4K now, and I'm covering those. And one of the things that are best known about those is the use of puppetry. The Jim Henson, Frank Oz, the whole Creature Shop was involved in both movies. And so I said, well, you know, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy back in 2005 was done with a lot of practical effects. I mean, there's a lot of digital stuff in there too, absolutely. But they use the Jim Henson Creature Shop to make some of the aliens. And I thought, oh, that'll be a nice one to revisit. And I found the BBC version on BritBox. So I figured that it would be a nice little bookend, and let's just talk about that. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and this is the 2005 movie version. A working-class Joe in England hitchhikes his way across space with his alien best friend, the president of the galaxy, and a clinically depressed robot named Marvin.
Arthur, what if I told you I was from another planet?
What the hell are those things?
Attention, people of Earth. I regret to inform you that in order to make way for the new hyperspace express route, your planet has been scheduled for demolition. Have a nice day.
Hang on, we're hitching a ride.
What is this thing?
It's the guide. It's got everything you need to know to survive in the universe. Arthur, this is Zaphod Beeblebrox, president of the galaxy.
He shares three of the same mothers as me.
When this came out in 2005, and it was like just a couple months before the third Star Wars prequel came out, so it really got under that radar. But The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has been considered unfilmable as a movie for years, and it wasn't until really the digital effects came along that they could construct a lot of the elements that they have in the film. But it's ultimately Douglas Adams' books, they're absurdist fiction. They're silliness, they're goofy, they're satirical, they put a mirror up against humanity, but at the same time say, what if none of this was that way? What if these elements were present in these aliens? Or what if these aliens didn't have these elements that are present in humans? And it goes, it's way out there, and it's as bizarre and as absurd as you could get. But it's also very, very British, because that's Douglas Adams. He was British. He was a British comedy writer. And he used to work on Doctor Who. He was in charge of the overall script of it, but he wrote several of the serials, the late ones with Tom Baker. It was after the Sarah James Smith years. And so, I mean, this stuff is silly and ridiculous, and that's kind of the point. Now, when this movie came out, I think if you don't know anything about Douglas Adams and you aren't aware of anything with The Hitchhiker's Guide, I think it was just too much for people. It's goofy and silly and weird. But at the same time, as much as it was, I think, a bit much for people who didn't know Douglas Adams' work, for people who were grounded in Douglas Adams' work, it tries to bridge the gap between the very British version of The Hitchhiker's Guide and tries to make it a little more accessible, particularly to Americans, but anybody who's not overly British. And I know that kind of cheesed off some Brits. I know there are some Brits who are like, that movie's terrible. I think they did a good job kind of managing the two. I mean, it has an absurdness to it, but they put some American people in it that I think bothered people. Like, you know, like Mos Def plays Ford Prefect, and he's not British, and Sam Rockwell plays Zaphod Beeblebrox, who is the president of the galaxy, and he's not British. So I think that irked some people, and they do make some changes, but ultimately the story is the story. But it's so fun to watch because of the creature effects, and they got the Vogons. The Vogons are these bureaucratic, pompous idiots who run the highway system in the galaxy, and these big blobby creatures who write terrible poetry. And the Vogons are done with the Jim Henson Creature Shops. They're physical puppets, and they look amazing. It's the last time I've seen really great puppet work in a movie, and that's 20 years ago almost. I still find this movie fun. It's available on Hulu right now, and that's where I got it. It was Disney. It should be on Disney Plus, but they're not putting everything on there anymore. And it's probably the best chance of mixing Douglas Adams' whimsy and modern visual effects while balancing that dry British humor. But it's not so dry that it's hard to watch for an American. It's just the story doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, and that's the point of the story. But still, I really like this version. I found it to be quite fun. I'm going to say The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Because I watched the 2005 version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I decided to track down the 1981 version. Now, you got to realize, Hitchhiker's Guide, the story, originated as a radio drama or a comedy. I mean, it was a radio play. And it was like 1978 or something like that. And it was popular enough that they said, hey, why don't you write this into a book? And then Douglas Adams wrote the book, and that was very popular. And then he did the sequel, The Restaurant, The End of the Universe. Then he did the third book, Life, the Universe, and Everything in the trilogy. And then he wrote a fourth book in the trilogy, So Long and Thanks for All the Fish. And so I think there's like six books in the trilogy at this point. But the books became international bestsellers, and they're very popular here. Well, shortly after the radio production, they did a TV production on the BBC. And used a lot of the people who originated these characters in the original production on the radio, brought to the television version. So this 1981 BBC production features the first visual adaptation of Douglas Adams' silly sci-fi classic.
The full story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is long, tortuous, and to be frank, pretty obscure. Gathering information for it has caused endless problems, but quite honestly, if you're the average four-headed, six-tentacled man about town, you really wouldn't be interested.
How would you react if I told you that I'm not from Guildford after all, but from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse?
I don't know. Why? Do you think it's the sort of thing you're likely to say?
It's ultimately the same story. That's the thing. It's and the story being, the Vogons come to blow up the Earth because the Earth is in the way of a hyperspace bypass, and Arthur Dent, this just schlub from England, hitches a ride with a friend of his on these spaceships, and they're going to kind of go tooling around the universe, and it's them trying to figure out why Earth was blown up and what they can do about it, but they go through these misadventures. It's real loosey-goosey in terms of a traditional storyline, because it was just meant to be a bunch of gags and meant to be absurdist. It's meant to not make sense. And that's one of its biggest challenges for a larger audience. Now, like I said, they have a lot of the people that were involved. The guy who played Zaphod Beeblebrox is the same guy who did on the radio. Same thing with the guy who played Arthur Dent. And the big thing holding this back is, it was made in 1981 by the BBC, and if anyone has ever watched Doctor Who from back in the 70s and 80s, they know full well that the BBC did not have a huge budget or a lot of effective special effects. So they're all, it's really bad special effects, and it's really low rent because it's BBC television in the early 1980s. But it is much more British, and it is authentically the delivery of these characters. So if you want to check that out, you can. That's on BritBox, and it kind of goes through the first two books. And I've read the second book, and I started reading the third book, but it just becomes a series of gags, and there's no real story. I can't even tell you what the story is to The Restaurant of the End of the Universe, which is the second one, and I recently reread that. So Douglas Adams' stuff is more a series of gags, and if you like that, it's good, but it's absurdist stuff that doesn't really have a plot. But the big problem with this one, it's cobbled with that 80s Doctor Who level budget and effects. But this version of Hitchhikers does retain the delivery and Britishness of the source. But I still think that this is an interesting version of it, as clunky as it is. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Lisa Frankenstein and Out of Darkness.
So long and thanks for all the fish. So sad that it should come to this. We try to warn you all but don't dare.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the new ones that are available in theaters this week. I guess this is going to be the big one. I mean, it's probably the biggest release of the weekend, and that is Lisa Frankenstein, or Frankenstein. A troubled teenager begins a relationship with a reanimated boy from a local abandoned cemetery.
Are you hot burning?
He doesn't play sports. I tend to his grave. I talk to him.
I wish I was with you.
You're him? I can't believe you're here. Do you like music? I have the cure.
Ooh.
Oh, not that kind of cure. They can't make you better. I mean, they can, but, like, emotionally.
What's funny about this one is it's one of those weird films that's being promoted more for the person who wrote it than directed it. I mean, you're still seeing the director's name on stuff, Zelda something. But it's Diablo Cody that is getting the most media attention. She did Juno, and that was a really good movie. I loved that movie. It was one of my favorites of that year. And so she came on very strong with that, and then she did a TV series called The United States of Terror, so she wrote that, and part of it is Diablo Cody was famous because she used to be a stripper, and that kind of was like her backstory. So it was a very intriguing backstory for just a writer. She wasn't just somebody sitting around drinking red wine and smoking cigarettes in an empty room with a typewriter. You know, it was almost cinematic what her story was. And she came on very quickly and won that Oscar and then struggled for years to do something else. And that's good and bad because it puts a spotlight on her and she's a compelling figure. But she's also, she is not the whole movie. It's just her script. I think she's a producer too, but you know, there's a director and there's a lot more involved in making a movie than just writing a script. The other thing is, and I looked up her filmography and I realized, with the exception of Juno, I really don't like her movies. I really don't like her scripts. She famously did the script for Jennifer's Body with Megan Fox. And that movie's awful. And people are trying to get it revisited. People are trying to be like, oh, no, let's go back and maybe it is a good movie. It's not. I haven't seen it in years, but I watched it when it came into theaters and I watched it on DVD. I remember not liking it. And what makes me not want to go watch it is then I looked at a bunch of other movies that she wrote and I didn't like any of those, like Young Adult, even though it got a lot of accolades. I hated that movie. I hated Ricky and the Flash. I really hated Tully. I mean, there's a lot of movies that she wrote that I not just disliked, but actively hated as films. It made my top worst movies of those years. So I'm like, okay, well, this makes sense, because then when I saw Lisa Frankenstein, I wasn't all that charged by it. Because here's the thing. It's trying to be this punchy and sort of cool and hip story, but I don't, I mean, it's trying to do this 80s nostalgia thing. And look, I grew up in the 80s. I lived in 1989. I was the same age as the character in this, because she was born in 1971. I was born in 1971. And so, I mean, I was of that era. And it's still, it's oversimplification of that era. It's like that 70s show aping the 80s. So, but the problem is that the story's very disjointed. It's as great of a trailer as it makes. It just doesn't hold together. It's supposed to be this you know, real punchy dialogue that she had in her stuff like in Juno. But that doesn't come across as authentic. Maybe it's because she's in her 40s now and she's not, you know, in her late 20s writing this stuff. And the you know, Catherine Newton's fine. She's good in it as the main character. But it lacks a real focus. And it drags. Oh my God! It's an intensely boring movie for as much neon glitz as it has in there. And it also weirdly doesn't. It has a strange moral compass, because look, I understand that there is this sort of subgenre of teenage movies where they do some horrible things. Great example is Heathers. I loved Heathers growing up, but Heathers involves murder and suicide. But there's like a right and wrong in Heathers. And there's been a lot of movies made like that, but this one just is sort of like, it crosses these lines, but then it's like, well, that's okay. And I'm like, what? You know, and then the whole idea of a reanimated dead body, a person falling in love with a corpse, that's nothing new. We've seen that before. I mean, we saw that in Warm Bodies, Teresa Palmer falling in love with Nicholas Holt. But even going all the way back in the 90s, there was a movie called My Boyfriend's Back where a guy reanimates, or even something like Deadly Friend, which was this kid having this fascination and brings back to life Christy Swanson's character. And we've seen these reanimated love stories before. So this is nothing new. And whether it's just okay, but it's almost like they're like, oh, look how original. It's not that original. I've seen these movies before. And Cole Sprouse does a decent job, or Dylan Sprouse, whichever one it is. You know, one of the kids from Suite Life plays the reanimated corpse, and he's got some good slapstick and some good physical comedy, but it just, The story's all over the place, and the characters are all over the place. And it's just not well written. For an Oscar-winning writer, it should have been better. I mean, the story takes an intriguing angle, but it just lacks the energy and cohesion between the clever zingers, which there's plenty of clever zingers, but you need more than just a couple of cool, hip phrases to make a coherent story. So I'm going to have to say Lisa Frankenstein, huge disappointment for me. It kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Out of Darkness. 45,000 years ago, a tribe of Stone Age humans face a violent enemy attacking them at night. I saw this as an early screening. They have this thing on AMC where they have this series called Screen Unseen, where you blind buy a ticket to this event and they show a movie that they don't tell you what the movie is, but it's a movie that hasn't been released yet. So I went to go see this and I hadn't heard about it a week before I saw it. And then I started hearing about it. And so it kind of moved out into all these other theaters. It's a challenging movie because it takes place 45,000 years ago. And it's this Stone Age tribe. So they don't speak English. And instead of just having them grunt around like cavemen, they actually have a language. But I don't know what language it is. I don't know if they really know what people were saying 45,000 years ago or if they just kind of guessed, which it's, I have a feeling they sort of guessed based on languages that they knew. I don't know. The linguist detail is lost on me, but because they don't speak English, it's all subtitled. Now, I mean, it's not My Dinner with Andre, you know, so it's not a lot of subtitles because it is just more or less an action horror flick. I mean, it's a bona fide horror movie because there's something in the background coming after them. And it's very violent. It's gory. It certainly earns its R rating. So it's a neat idea, but boy, it is very limiting putting that kind of subtitles on there. And I'm not talking about something like, remember Apocalypto, the movie that Mel Gibson directed? That one had subtitles. It's a neat way to do it because it feels authentic. You know, because it's weird to have cavemen talking English. But even compare it to something like Quest for Fire, which never really had any language to it. It was just grunts and noises. But they're a little more sophisticated of a civilization. It's effectively done, and it works as a horror movie. I wasn't completely thrilled with how things resolved, but I'll tell you, just like everything I've been talking about for weeks, if you go to a theater and they're not projecting it properly, it looks like crap because it takes place mostly at night. It's called Out of Darkness. So there's a lot of things in shadow, and I don't mind the cinematography in this, because that's necessary for what they were doing. But if they're running the ball below, you don't see stuff very well. And that's just more a local theater thing. I mean, while the premise and the prehistoric language barrier limits its audience, there's some fine moments of horror baked into this drama. I'm going to say this one kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the new transfers of The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth.
You remind me of the babe. What? Power of voodoo.
Voodoo.
You do.
Do what?
Remind me of the babe.
I saw my baby cry.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're going to be talking about two movies that are new on 4K and digital download. This is, I think, where we're going with the future of watching movies at home. And I know there's a lot of people who love physical media. I love physical media. But there certainly seems to be a push or a leaning towards digital downloads. And I understand it. The biggest problem with digital downloads and for stuff that you purchase on streaming, I'm not talking about streaming services that you're looking into their library. It's stuff you actually pay money and quote-unquote own that there's a danger in that. The danger of not having a physical release is whoever puts that together, if they don't provide the upkeep of those files, or there's a rights issue that causes a problem, those might disappear. And there have been stories where maybe somebody's moved to a different country and they don't have access to their movies because all the stuff they bought was licensed in America, but not in England, for example. So I think we're going to start seeing more of this. These are just new 4K releases and they're promoting it pretty heavily. So they are there, but they're not. There's not a physical media side to that. So this is just kind of, I think, where a lot of things are going, not just with, not with any specific company. I think we're going to start seeing, I'm already starting to see that with like Warner Brothers or Columbia releasing on-demand stuff, but they really don't have a physical release, or they have a much more muted push for the physical release. That sound means we're rolling into the home cinema roundup. First of the selections is The Dark Crystal. Like I said, this is available on 4K. In another realm and another time, a group of evil creatures rule the land, but their benevolent counterparts send a child to heal the schism that fractured their world.
Oh, the prophecy says you must find the crystal shard to save our world.
All right, alone then.
Another great conjunction coming up. Better have your shard before that, Gelfly.
Which one of us will be the new emperor?
When single shines the triple sun, shall be whole, the two made one.
This is a piece of the dark crystal.
This movie came out in the early 80s, I think 1982. And here's one of the dangers of 4K. And I'm not slagging 4K, but we are getting resolution, home video resolution, so high that you're going to start seeing the strings, you know, in a movie like this. That's, to me, a little bit of a charm to it. But what's so great about The Dark Crystal is it's immersive. There's no humans in it. There's a couple shots of, like, the Gelfling as the where you can tell they've got a kid in an outfit or a small person in an outfit. And so they can do those from far away. But everything else is a puppet. You know, the close-ups of the Gelflings, the characters, everybody's a puppet. And like the Skeksis, which are the bad guys, you know, they had, you know, multiple people operating those puppets. So they don't move super fast. And it's funny, I remember revisiting, I showed this to my kids like 20 years ago. And I was surprised at how slow the characters move. But that's because you had multiple people handling a puppet at a time. And they're full articulated creatures. Now, there's The Age of Resistance, which is on Netflix. It's a series. They only did one season of that. And they used to have the streaming rights to The Dark Crystal, I think. They don't now. And the only place you can get it is if you get it through this. If you're going to get it through Shout Factory, because you got the 4K. I mean, unless, you know, physical media, that's a different thing. But if you want to have the streaming thing, this comes with a whole bunch of special features. I haven't had a chance to check out the special features yet, but the print looks amazing. I mean, it's Shout Factory does a very good job in making their stuff look great, and they take care in producing it. So to see the crisp 4K version of this movie in probably one of the better ways you're going to see it, you know, this is definitely worth checking out. And also because the puppetry is so amazing. Like all the characters, like I said, every single character in this is a puppet of some sort, you know, a Muppet, because it was the Jim Henson Creature Shop. So, you know, but the thing I loved about this movie is so dark, and it's so creepy and weird. And I mean, I loved it as a kid, and I'm watching it, but they have some pretty kind of traumatic stuff. They like drain the essence from these podlings, I think is what they're called. They're these little elf type creatures, and they drain their essence and then they drink it. I mean, it's very, very disturbing at a time. And I think it could freak out kids. But you know, back in the 80s, this was kids' shows. So, yeah, I mean, it was dark and visionary, but this compelling fantasy uses amazing puppetry to tell its story. It still totally rocks. I love The Dark Crystal.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to the next Jim Henson creature feature from the 80s, and that is Labyrinth, again, available 4K streaming. You can get it through Shout Factory. A teenage girl wishes to be rescued from babysitting her stepbrother and is whisked away to a fairy tale land where the Goblin King wants them to stay forever.
Those are the gates to the Goblin City.
Beware. I wish the goblins would come and take you away.
The way forward is sometimes the way back.
How are you enjoying my labyrinth?
It's a piece of cake.
Really?
I have to get to the center of the labyrinth.
Even if you get to the center, you'll never get out again.
You have 13 hours in which to solve the labyrinth before your baby brother becomes one of us forever.
Now, apparently after The Dark Crystal came out, they wanted to do another fantasy adventure with the Jim Henson Creature Shop, but they didn't want something as dark and creepy as The Dark Crystal. There's still some dark and creepy elements to Labyrinth. There's still some nightmare fuel populating this movie, but it's not nearly as traumatic as The Dark Crystal. But it is weird, because they got David Bowie to play the Goblin King, and he's great in it, because David Bowie's pretty much great in anything he ever did. But, you know, he's like, I think at the time, he was at least in his 40s when he was doing this, or close to it. And Jennifer Connelly was like 16. This is one of her, this is kind of a breakout role. And she was really good in this movie. But he, of course, wants to get with her, which I guess is, that's Hollywood. You know, hey, there you go. But he sings several songs in here, which they're really kind of ham-fisted in, crammed into the movie the way they crammed the Prince songs into Batman in 1989, 3 years later. But I remember seeing Labyrinth in the theaters. I remember seeing Dark Crystal in the theater, too. But I remember seeing Labyrinth in the theater and being a little underwhelmed. But I think it has grown. It's become better with time because it feeds into the nostalgia. You see the brilliant use of the puppetry. And ultimately, when you look back at this, and I've seen so many more movies, this plays on dream logic. One of the things I heard people talking about The Boy and the Heron, which I talked about several weeks ago, they talked about the Japanese style of filmmaking, the Japanese style of storytelling with the Hayao Miyazaki film, and that's designed under dream logic. And dream logic is stuff that doesn't quite make sense. And people in America don't generally like it because dream logic doesn't follow the rules of the world, but it follows the way dreams are, which can be a little bit disjointed and jump around and be weirdly focused on a certain character. In a lot of ways, this plays, Labyrinth does, plays like The Wizard of Oz. Jennifer Connelly's character is very much like Dorothy. She wants to be whisked away to another world, and then she has to follow this path. And on the way down the path, she meets several friends, and they are going to help her topple the ruler of this world, which is essentially that's the same story. So it has a lot of these parallels to The Wizard of Oz that make it work as a story. And that's where I say it plays with the dream logic. Like, you know, she befriends everybody and everybody becomes fast friends and everybody works well together. And this was one, when I was talking about with The Dark Crystal, with the 4K imagery, every now and then you see like a stick or a string. There's one character and he's a sort of a swashbuckling fox with a sword or a rapier. And in one scene, he comes and does something, and you can totally see the marionette stick for the arm. Now, obviously, you see that when you see Kermit the Frog in the Muppet Show, but that's just kind of part of that. But I think they really work to try and hide any of the realistic mechanisms. You're going to see that on like a really high-def thing. Those things are going to be much easier to see than they were on like a VHS tape back in the 80s at 240 lines of resolution. But still, it's a neat movie. It's visionary. It's not as visionary as The Dark Crystal, but I still love it for sort of what it represents. And there are some brilliant elements of puppetry. So, I mean, the dream logic storytelling is simultaneously warm and frustrating, but it's a valid look into the fantasy mind of a child with brilliant puppetry effects. I warmly remember this movie, and it's a relic of the 80s, but it's a beautiful relic. I'm going to say that Labyrinth totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for this week. I got to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Madam Web. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.